Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning into the podcast. I just want to take a moment to mention the podcast sponsor, retrogamestore.com.au. Head over there for all your Game Boy refurbish and repair needs. Screens, shells, buttons, all the bits and pieces. And there's a complete custom build made to order service as well. Also, plenty more retro gaming goodness like video cables, display stand and power supplies, controllers, etc. And you can add the code PixelPie at checkout to get 10% off your order. Also, take a moment to say if you enjoyed this episode and haven't already, give it a subscribe or follow and a review where you can. And maybe you want to recommend the Pixel Pie podcast to anyone you know that would enjoy it. That'd be really appreciated. So thanks for listening. And now let's get on with the show.
Hey, everybody. This is Jim from the Kids Short You Can channel on YouTube, and you are listening to the Pixel Pie podcast.
Hello, Jim. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing okay. How are you?
I am really good. I'm talking to you, Jim, Kid Shoryuken. You've got a YouTube channel and some Instagram, and this is really refreshing for me because you're in Tokyo, Japan, and our time zone is 1 hour apart. And that's it's really good to work with because a lot of guests I've had are from like Europe or the US, so it's either 14 hours or 8 hours, and yeah, it's easy already. I feel this conversation is going to be nice and easy. So how you doing, mate? How's things?
You know, things are pretty good. I suppose yep. They could be better, but I guess they could always be better. But yeah, I don't have any real significant complaints right now. We're currently at the ass end of a very long state of emergency here in Tokyo. Mm. But that's been just a royal pain in the ass for all concerned. But that's about to be lifted, I think next week, end of this month. Very and cool. Things should be hopefully starting to settle back down to normal. But aside from that, yeah, no real complaints.
Yeah, good. Just to sort of cut to, I guess your shtick in a fashion, your YouTube it's a lot of you living in Tokyo, and a lot of it is you wandering around, seeking out those, secondhand retro games, you know, going to the hard offs and the super potatoes and all these other little sort of cabins full of gems. And part of that is you sharing what it's like just to live in Tokyo. Now, you're from the US originally. So I guess when I first started sort of watching you and enjoying just watching you wander around a massive Sega arcade, I was like, how did this guy from the US end up living in Tokyo? So do you want to maybe take us back through that, how that all started?
Yeah. Back in 2008, I entered the United States Air Force. Mm-hmm. And I was first sent to Ramstein Air Base in Germany.
Wow.
Where I was a medic, so I worked at the clinic there. Yeah. And I was there for about 2 years, and in early 2010, I got notified that I had gotten a new assignment to Yokota Air Base, which is sort of out on the outskirts of Tokyo in mm-hmm. an area called Fusa, which I thought was pretty cool at the time, you know. As a kid, I'd always enjoyed a lot of video games, obviously. Some anime and things like that. Yeah. So, Japan seemed like that would be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So in 2010, in the summer that year, I came to Japan. I was, again, working at the hospital mm-hmm. at Yokota Air Base there in Fusa in West Tokyo. And from 2010 to 2014, with a little six-month deployment, that's what I was doing. And then I left in the summer of 2014. I got stationed at a place called Laughlin Air Base in Del Rio, Texas, mm-hmm. which is a tiny little South Texas, like desert town, like 10 minutes from the Mexican border.
What a contrast.
Yes, big change. I went from Tokyo to way down in South Texas. Yes, which was a big change. Cheap to live, really good Mexican food, but just boring, really boring.
And not a lot of retro game stores to hunt through.
There was one retro game store there. I can't even remember the
Yeah,
name
right.
now, but I remember the owner, Joel. He would contact me all the time. I guess somehow or another he found out. Maybe he watched the channel or something, but he found out that I was there. And so he would contact me all the time, wanting me to go to his store. And I
Yeah.
wasn't buying any games or anything. I was saving up everything because I was intending to move back to Tokyo in 2015 after I completed my service. So I never went to, I wouldn't go to his store because I was like, I don't really have any reason to. I don't want to buy any games or anything. But then I was like, you know what? When I move back, it might be cheaper if I kind of lighten my load a little bit. So I did eventually start going to that store and selling him just like a ton of stuff out of my collection. I sold him tons of games and consoles and everything. But in 2015, I came back to Japan. When you get out of the military in the US, you get the GI Bill, which pays for, I think it was like up to like 40 grand worth of higher education.
Like college or something.
So, So I'd done some research and found that there were a couple of American schools with campuses in Tokyo, and they accepted the GI Bill. So I had a girlfriend at the time, a Japanese woman who was living in Kanagawa. We'd been dating for, a couple of years. So the plan was leave the military, come back to Japan. We live together. I finish school, and then we carry on from there. So I was living when I first came back in 2015. I was living in a city called Odawara out in Kanagawa Prefecture, which is the prefecture south of Tokyo. And I was commuting into the city. I was first going to a college called Lakeland University. Which their home campus is in Wisconsin, and they have a remote campus in Shinjuku of all places.
So these are like
So I started going to school.
American students.
It's a international crowd, so you'll have like half of the student body will be Japanese, and then the other half will be, there'll be a lot of Americans, obviously, but there'll be people from maybe Korea, Canada, even Australia, places like that.
And what were you teaching?
I was studying. I
Oh, you
was
were at the universe, at the college or whatever, right? Attending, right? I'm with you.
Yes. I signed up for the military when I was 20 years old. I didn't have any college education at the time. So I had taken some courses while I was in the military, but other than that, I had no real, college education. So I was attending Lakeland University. And I wanted, there's another bigger school in Tokyo called Temple University, and their home campus is in Philadelphia. In the US, they're like a top 50 school. It's a really nice school. And I applied there first, and they were like, you don't really have a whole lot of coursework. We'd like to see a little more of that before we'll accept you. But Lakeland is there. They're typically like the campus here is a 2-year campus, and you transfer over to another home campus if you want to do the 4-year program. They're like, you take do some coursework there. If you do well enough, then we'll reevaluate you. So I went to Lakeland. I did pretty well. I was on the dean's list while I was there and finished an AA
What were you
and so
studying?
transferred. Well, when I was at Lakeland, it was just the basics. My AA was just in liberal arts studies. I transferred over to Temple where initially, I didn't know if I wanted to study Japanese extensively or what, but I was becoming more and more interested in working with media. So I ended up majoring in communications, which is kind of broad, but generally speaking, you learn about I studied production, I studied film, I studied broadcasting, I even studied acting and things to that effect. And just while all this was going on, I broke up with my girlfriend
Oh, shame.
that I was living with in Kanagawa.
That happens.
Yeah, it was really too bad. Yeah, it does. But after that, I didn't have to commute to Tokyo anymore. I just moved back into Tokyo, And yeah, after that, finished school, took my current job. I'm a teacher now and YouTuber as well, all that good stuff. But that's kind of a long answer to a simple question.
That's interesting. I mean, I'll, this is why I have these conversations with people like yourself, because you, like you and I were kind of discussing, this is real. And I guess sometimes things come, when things come into your own attention, like, oh, who's this guy? Oh, I'll watch his videos. And, you know, probably for the last couple of years, at least, I've watched your videos, but it's like, you didn't just like, poof, just, it just appear in Tokyo and, and that's how you get there. And like I explained to you before, my family and I, in 2017, I want to say, we spent 2.5 weeks in Osaka and Tokyo and went up into the snow a little bit. And it is a real paradise for those that have a real affinity for the Japanese culture, and especially gaming and anime and stuff. But it also, I've explained to some people, it's the closest to like being on another planet without leaving the planet. Everything's so similar, and there's just enough barrier, whether it be slightly, barrier is probably a harsh word, but difference in culture and language. But when you're there for that period of time, every Japanese person you come in contact with is so polite. Like my country, Australia, we could take a real leaf out of the way they treat their guests, because there were situations that where, like, we were walking down through Takashita Street, and my wife brought some of this like caramelized ginger, and we ducked into a McDonald's, and I had to go to the toilet. And as I was coming back out, they were sitting at the little front table, and this Japanese girl from the McDonald's, she's sort of like, you know, arms crossed, and she basically said to us, she was really, really sorry, really sorry, but we had to eat that outside. And it was just a prime example of a person saying, these are the rules, and it'd be really nice if you could do them. And we just saw that everywhere. But I also know people that have lived in Japan, and it has its challenges. You know, it's a very sort of, you'd walk past late. I was doing stuff with my family all day, and then going into Akihabara at night, and at 10 o'clock at night, I'm seeing these like noodle places and all these salarymen, being the typical guy that in a suit, at 10 o'clock at night eating his noodles. And I'm like, this is bizarre. And it, for you, it must have been an experience to kind of either just stay you or somehow get sort of folded into that, or live on the fringe of it sort of all the time.
Well, I've kind of had two different experiences, because anyone will tell you, like, when you're in the military and you're stationed overseas, an American military base is almost like a little American gated community.
Yeah.
Where you can feel more or less like you're still at home. I mean, English with everyone, and go to, you know, your Chili's, go to the supermarket and get all the American products and everything like that. And some people, you know, they more or less will stick to the base, and they don't really, they leave to go do some touristy things, but other than that, you know, that's kind
of
like
retreat back to the safety of the barracks, basically.
Yeah. And I tried to not do that as much as I could. Like, as soon as I could, I was like, okay, I got a car, I'm out of here. Like, when I had time off, I'm like, I'm gonna go drive out here, I'm gonna go do this and that, I'm gonna go hang out. And so, like, a lot of the friends that I have now, I made those friends while I was still in the military, just because I made an effort to just get out and go, you know, hang out, meet people, go to bars, and just do whatever. And but it still is a totally different experience from that to just living you know, in Tokyo without any kind of safety net, you know. It works for some people, other people not so much. You know, like, if you're here for like a little while, you know, everything's cool. If you've been here for like 10 years, obviously, you know, in any place you go, there are going to be some pricks. And so, you know, I've like run into a few of them, but then, like, it doesn't really hurt my feelings so much, because one, I grew up in a place where I knew a lot of pricks, and then I was in the military for the 7 years.
And
you're going to deal with the biggest assholes you've ever met in your life when you're in the military.
So
I didn't, you know, it's pretty hard to hurt my feelings. That being said, though, I've known people that have, against some of the younger people I went to college with, they were like, oh man, I'm at, like, one guy in particular, I've told this story before, I met him on the orientation day at Lakeland, and we were just chatting, and I was like, so what brought you to Japan? He was like, oh, you know, I just always liked anime and stuff, and I just wanted to come and check it out. And after that first semester, he was gone. His opinion on Japan changed 180 degrees, and he was, you know, he could not acclimate. And I think a big part of it was he just got his feelings hurt easily. Like he would complain all the time. Like if somebody, you know, people didn't want to, a common complaint is nobody wants to sit next to me on the train. Like if I sit down on the train, there's a seat open next to me. Everyone just sort of stands around and I'm like, why isn't anyone sitting next to me? And you get self-conscious. You're like, oh, it must be because I'm a foreigner, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I guess he had some other experiences too. Maybe something was like said to him or he wasn't allowed into some business or something.
Yeah.
And that was enough to do it. And like, I've had those experiences myself. I've had people like say, you know, really mean stuff to me. I've had people sort of react to my presence really unpleasantly. I've been denied access to certain drinking establishments and things like that. I've been denied housing. I've been told I had to go through a whole bunch of places to find a new apartment until I, you know, you get to someone that will actually rent to a foreign resident and things like that. So there's all kinds of stuff that like you complain, you can complain about and you can take really personally.
For sure.
I just chose not to.
And that's pretty recent too. I think it's only in the last 12 months that you've changed your living circumstances. And I think that's something that I really like about what you put up on YouTube is, you know, life isn't always rosy. And I think we were talking prior to this, it was maybe 12, 18 months ago. I think we're talking maybe even probably pre-pandemic. I don't like to dwell on it, but it's obviously it's a thing on the calendar that's easy to refer to. And I think you were kind of some of your YouTube, like a lot of YouTube is like digging through a heart off or you know, super potatoes, but some of it is just like, hey, I'm Jim, this is what I'm doing today and this is how I'm feeling. Yeah. And you were kind of like I guess the grind of just YouTubing in general was you were feeling the weight of it. And I think it's important that people understand that it's not a bed of roses when you're like, you got a lot of challenges in your life. Like you could be that guy complaining about a bunch of stuff and doing this for fun. And then watching you go through the process of finding a new apartment. Like it's a lot of challenges to be in a foreign country. And at any moment you could have really just pulled the pin, jumped on a plane and probably come home. That's probably an option for you. But you've got to be adventurous if you want to stick these things out and get the rewards and the life experience that you're getting.
Yeah. I mean, it's an option to, go home, but then I consider like, what am I going home to really? Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't grow up in like a part of the US where opportunities abound, you know?
Yeah.
So if I were to go back to the US, I'd have to, if I really wanted to go somewhere where there was an opportunity to kind of like do the stuff I'm doing now, which I'm enjoying, you know, the whole YouTube thing and all that stuff, that's great. But like, if I went home, I really don't know how I would really carry on. I would have to change the entire sort of crux of what I do completely. And I wouldn't be able to like live off of my like YouTube or anything. So the kind of work I think I would do if I went home, it wouldn't be anything I would want to do. Like as of right now, I am a teacher. I had never had any desire to be a teacher like at all. It was never something that was like on my radar. But it was just one of those things where, towards the end of my time at university, I was interning for a production company and I was really enjoying it. I was going on shoots. I was learning a lot about cameras and editing. And the owner of the company, he, you know, they had a YouTube channel, but they didn't really know what to do with it. They didn't have any sort of direction for it. And so at the time when I got there, because two of my friends were already working there, one was a production assistant, the other was a producer. And I wanted to go and start doing an internship there. And they talked to the owner, a guy named Toshi, and they were like, you know, he's like a YouTuber. He's been at it for a little while. We got jack shit for our like social media presence and YouTube.
Yeah.
They had published 60 videos on YouTube at that point, but they had 40 subscribers.
Right.
So they were really going nowhere, and their videos were really shitty. They were really boring, and it was all just like text and crappy music and some sort of whatever random information they thought might be interesting to people. So when I went there, the owner, he was like, you know, we want you to help on shoots and everything like that. And, you know, we'll, you know, show you how to do what we do here. But we could really use some help with all this YouTube stuff. And I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. So I pitched a bunch of ideas and things like that. Within a few months, I brought them from 40 subscribers up to about 1,000.
Wow.
So it was going pretty good. I was like, you got to kill all this lame text bullshit. Get rid of that. You need to have people on camera.
Yeah.
You need to have presenters. You need to have voiceovers. You need to create sort of like a personal connection with the videos.
Yeah.
And you need to have, like, you know, it's YouTube. It's not television. You have to bring the audience to you.
Yeah.
So you got to have like cool shit in there, man. Like, yeah, it has to be something fun.
It's gonna be worth people's time.
So like the first thing I really did with them was we went to a car show. I was like, car show's awesome. I'm like, there's going to be cool ass cars. There's going to be hot chicks everywhere.
Yeah.
I was like, oh man, we got to do this. And there was other stuff because we were producing a lot of stuff for AP, Allied Press back in, I guess they're a UK based, media thing, but they distribute around Europe, I suppose. So we would just look at what events and things are coming up or what might be interesting. And we'd pitch all this stuff to AP, and whatever they would pick up on, they would, you know, want something for, okay, we're going to do that. And so I was like, well, if we're going to go shoot all this shit for AP, let's shoot extra footage and just use that ourselves.
Yeah. Nice.
I'm like, we're already gonna be there. So like, they're like, hey, we're going to go shoot at this aquarium. They're having some deep sea creatures event or whatever. I was like, that sounds dumb, but all right, you know, we can do something with that. So we did stuff like that. They were doing this thing where there was this, like a J-pop concert, but it was these VTubers, the virtual YouTubers, where it's all mocap and they're, you know, anime, 3D anime characters.
Right.
So we went to this concert where that's what it was. It was all these people there to watch just sort of like holographic images.
So was it live? Someone was somewhere else and it was kind of being done as opposed to recording and the app. Yes. Like, have you seen the ABBA thing that's going down at the moment?
ABBA?
Yeah, you know who ABBA is, right? The Swedish band from the...
Yes, ABBA, but what's happening with ABBA?
So they're doing a thing at the moment where they just recently dropped some information about, we've got a new album coming out, but what... And then slowly it kind of got released. What's actually happening is they're creating a holographic virtual concert, a full concert. And I mean, I think we all saw it coming, you know, there's like been a few, is it like one of the rappers did it for his girlfriend's.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like that's, and I think they did Michael Jackson once and things like that.
They did Michael Jackson, Freddie Mercury, Tupac.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. The Tupac. So this is a full concert. And you will go, and I guess they're talking about the fact that, you know, they can write new music and they can. So, yeah, that wasn't. But the, what you're talking about, it's a total side thing. But a final stuff, obviously, with the pandemic, you know, this is a thing that's going to start happening. So
it's segue. Very similar. It's very similar to that because in Japan there was already the Vocaloid kind of thing that went on, which is like characters like Hatsune Miku and some other characters where they are 100%. Like fictitious, so it's just a projected like holographic image. It's the same technology used to do like the Tupac and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and the voice is also synthetic, so there's nothing real about this character. With this, the VTuber thing, these are real people. They are in some location. I don't know where they would have been, but they would have been in like mocap suits, and they're dancing and they're singing and they're doing the performance. But what you as the audience see are these virtual sort of like avatars they've created for themselves.
So cool.
So we went to one of those. It was cool, but it was also really fucking weird.
It's pretty dinky.
Like the audience there and everything. And they've got I had never been to like a J-pop concert or anything like that, or an idol concert, as I say, because it's not really my thing.
Yeah.
So just being there and, you know, watching the people with their glow sticks and doing their thing, like, it was cool. It was like odd to me. It wasn't something I'd experienced before, and that they were doing it for these characters, not necessarily even like people that they wanted to see, just like characters that, you know, it was a very Sonichu kind of thing. I was like, that's not real, but you really seem to be into it.
It's like that band Gorillaz, you remember?
Yeah.
And it's like Gorillaz. They came out and it's like, until they kind of got on stage, it was really cool. And all of a sudden it's like, now you kind of like some weird Sesame Street looking thing. And I don't quite get it now.
Well, it's Gorillaz. And also it was a cartoon series on Adult Swim called Metalocalypse.
Oh, right. No, I'm not aware of that one.
So in this cartoon series, it's a show about a death metal band called Death Clock.
Right.
And so, you know, it's totally fictional, but there's actual really great music in the show that is produced by the show's creator. And so the music was so good, he would release albums, and then he goes to do like live performances. And typically when they would do the live performances, at least early on, the stage would be almost totally dark and the performers are on the stage, but then behind them is a screen with the various music videos with the cartoon characters doing all the, you know,
their stuff. So you were getting what they were getting, but like kind of bigger and louder. I've been to a couple of kind of like Comic Cons, and there's a thing here in, I can't remember, it's like a Supernova Comic Con here in Australia. I've been to the one in Sydney. I spent quite a couple of years like really big on Gundam, and GBWC is maybe something you're aware of, and they do an Australian league. And you'd go there and there'd be a stage and there'd be these bands just playing these ripping covers of game music that I was not aware of. But some people were so into that. And that was here in Australia. And I imagine like in Japan, it's just such a, you know, every thread is just so thick and full. I was going to say before, have you ever heard of a band called Cybertronic Spree? They're on YouTube. Are you aware of this band?
I don't believe I have heard of them.
No. They kind of like each of the band member kind of dresses up a bit like a kind of like an Autobot or some sort of weird Gundam-y thing. And they do a really good cover of like Barracuda by Heart. And it's just one of those things. It's like a Kiss cover band, but they've kind of gone that next level and it's just fun. Like but rad.
One of my all-time favorite bands is GWAR. And GWAR is a band where it's all characters, you know, each band member plays a character and their performances on stage are always in character, and the music, some of their albums are almost like the album just like tells a story of them, I don't know, attacking America or taking over the world.
The way music used to
be. Or doing, whatever it is they do. And then if someone in the band dies, well, then it's sort of written into the story of why that character is no longer in the band. Maybe the character died, or the character was shot off into space, or something like that happened. And then, you know, they'll bring in a new guitarist, and maybe the character that the guitarist is playing is maybe related to that previous character.
Oh, so there's a real lore, kind of like a fantasy lore behind it, as opposed to just, he was a jerk, we got rid of him, and he's our new bass player.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the previous guitarist was, I think his name was Corey Smoot, but he played a character named Flatulus Maximus, and he was their lead guitarist, and then Corey himself died, and so they just sort of wrote it into the story that Flatulus, I don't remember how they explained it, but either Flatulus died or something else happened. And so I think he was replaced by, I guess, either his brother or a cousin, someone related to him named Pustulus Maximus.
Right.
And so, and obviously his thing is he has like pimples all over his face and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But that's happened numerous times. Their lead singer for like decades, a guy named Dave Brocky, his character was named Odorous Urungus. And he died in the past few years as well. And so they wrote off his character somehow. They gave him an actual like Viking funeral. So sent him out in a ship and set the ship on fire and everything.
Wow.
He was replaced briefly by a female singer named Volvatron. but she partied too hard even for them. So they had to kind of write her out of the mix. And now I believe the newest singer is Blothar. And I think he actually, the bass player has, the character has always remained the same. It's Beefcake. And I think he's actually been played by a few people. I think the current Blothar used to be Beefcake, but is now Blothar, I think. But anyway, that's just one of my, I like it when bands do stuff like that.
So I think
instead of them, you know, being in the spotlight, like me, Dave, I'm the lead singer of the band or whatever. Like he, like they, the whole thing was, if you ever saw them out of costume, the joke was like, they are slaves of Gwar. So they work in service to Gwar. So even in costume, they might make reference to their real selves, but they as like slaves or sex slaves or something like that.
Right. Wow, that's some work. That's some work.
Yeah.
And I think we were sort of I keep sidetracking us, but we were getting to when you were becoming a teacher.
Yeah.
So you were doing the car shows and the holographic J-pop and stuff. And
yeah, and I had a lot of ideas for them. I was like, we should go to a drift race track and get some really sweet drift racing footage and talk to some of the drivers. We should go to one of these like Muscle Man bars where like these bars where you're served by almost like Chippendales type dudes. Like they're the opposite of you know there's like the maid cafes where it's like, you know, really cute little girls in maid costumes serving you.
Yeah,
so you can go here and so I was like, we should do that, we should do drift racing, we should do like these weird conventions and things. I was pitching all these ideas and we never got to do any of them because as I'm graduating, I'm like, all right, well, I need full-time employment. And the owner Toshi was like, yeah, that's not gonna work, we're not gonna be able to give you that full-time gig.
Bugger.
So I was like, yeah, all right, so I gotta go find a job teaching, especially if you're teaching English in Japan, is seen usually as like the easiest way to go if you're a native English speaker and you're educated. And yeah, so I left there. I was replaced by like three or four unpaid interns. And they kind of drove it into the ground a little bit. Not the company itself. Like while I was there, like I did a little bit of work for like Toshiba. Like I did some editing for them. I did some voiceover work for their corporate videos and things. And that was cool. And we were doing work with Nissan and all this kind of shit. So, but their YouTube stuff was just like, they tanked it because they're like, here. So that last guy, he was an intern and he did pretty good with it. You all probably know YouTube stuff too, right? Here you go. You good can luck. Have it.
Yeah.
And they just did a terrible job with it. I don't think since then they really just almost not completely abandoned their YouTube stuff, but almost entirely abandoned it. But yeah, I went from there to teaching. Like I said, I had never wanted to be a teacher, but it was just kind of one of those things where, you know what, I want to stay here, but I need a proper working visa. So yeah, took a job teaching. I've found I have a knack for it. I actually enjoy it.
So this is teaching English to Japanese local students?
Yeah. So I teach, I think my youngest students are like 5 years old.
Is this in a classroom?
Yes.
Yeah.
In a classroom. So the youngest students are five. My oldest students are adults.
Yep.
So I teach adult classes. I teach high school, junior high, elementary school. I teach anybody that wants to come and learn. And I've been doing that for over 2 years now, almost 2.5 years, actually. And yeah, it's good. It's something I've been pretty good at. I'm a pretty effective communicator. And I'm good at, I guess, despite how much of a self-imposed isolationist I can be at times. I'm actually do have some decent people skills. So I keep the students around because it's a private institute, so they can leave whenever they want.
Right.
It's not like a government, you know, public school or something where they have to be there. So you have to, you know, perform, you have to, produce results. So
yeah.
So far so good.
Yeah. Cool. So like, let's maybe get into some of the actual sort of gaming, I guess. Now, so have you, like, even prior to you know, Air Force and that age, Jim, as a young Jim, you know, do you have Christmases fond memories of your first Nintendo, or, you know, was it the PlayStation era that kind of really kicked you into gear? Because these days, as an observer and as a person that enjoys watching what you do, you know, you're primarily walking around Japan, around Tokyo, to these hard offs, which are the kind of like, I guess they're a little bit like a thrift store, but a lot more upmarket, a lot more respect for the products, and very specified in the electronics and things like that. And you're finding, you know, these cartridges and games and consoles, sometimes at good prices and sometimes not. But, you know, you must have started somewhere way back when you're like, hey, retro gaming is cool, and then realized that was staying in Japan part of that, or did you sort of grow up and just happen to fall there and it was just a bonus?
Well, I've been a gamer my whole life.
Yeah.
I'm the youngest of six kids.
Wow. A lot of hand-me-downs then.
Yeah, plenty of hand-me-downs. Yeah. My older brother next up for me, because I have my older sister and then my older brother. My brother, he's, I think, 7 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up, and he liked video games. So as soon as I could, there was a Nintendo there.
Mm.
And his favorites were Mega Man, like especially. He was a huge Mega Man fan. And things like Castlevania, Zelda, stuff like that.
Oh.
So
he liked torturing himself a bit then, did he?
Yes, he did. So when he wasn't, you know, playing the Nintendo, I got a shot at it. So I mean, and what, you know, kid, you know, being like 5 years old, wouldn't just like love Mega Man and Mario and things like that.
Yeah.
Started with an NES, my older brother's games and things like that. In I think 1993. We got a Super Nintendo for Christmas, and then that just carried on, renting lots and lots of games from the video store every chance we got.
Yeah.
From there on, my brother soon moved out when he was like, I want to say 17 or 18, he moved out. So all the video games then just became mine.
Awesome.
And it's one of those things where, like, when there are six kids in the house and, you know, mom and dad don't really make that much money, you know things have to be kind of like rationed out, and there's not a whole lot of money to go around. But by the time it's whittled from six kids down to like two kids at home, there's like a little more to go around. So that was when, like, Christmas is coming up. Okay, maybe I can't get this console the year it comes out. That's a little, you know, too much, but maybe like a year down the line or something, I could ask for it or something like that. So like maybe like 97, I get a PlayStation.
Right.
Just absolutely love the PlayStation. I had friends. It was, you know, a common thing. Just, you know, lend games to your friends.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I'll let you borrow this. You let me borrow that. And that was how I played a lot of the games I really enjoyed at the time, was just like, sharing games with friends and renting a lot of games. And then every once in a while getting to own one. And it just carried on from there. Usually, you know, you always have to wait till Christmas to get something like a console. But yeah, from there, Dreamcast, eventually PS2, when I was the only kid left at home, and it was, you know, they're not really buying Christmas presents for all the other kids and stuff. I'm the only one they have to worry about. I'm still a teenager. So I was like, I didn't even really know anything about GameCube. I hadn't played a Nintendo console in like a while, but I was like, can I have a GameCube, I guess? Yeah. And they're like, they're like $200. Sure, you can have one. So it just carried on from there. When I was a teenager, though, I started working and still living at home. I was just like saving my paychecks and then going to eBay and buying stuff that at the time I thought would have been really cool, because it was all stuff I wanted from magazine adverts and stuff back in the day.
Yeah.
So when I was like, I don't know, 17, I think, 17 or 18, I got like a 3DO and, you know, 32X, Sega CD, all this stuff.
Yeah.
With the money I was making stocking shelves and just having all this stuff and thinking it was pretty cool, but most of the games were shitty. And so it's just like I had a collection of games but not like a huge collection now. But leaving home, going into the military, when I was in Germany, I wasn't playing too many video games. Like I had an Xbox 360 and I would play like Fallout and stuff like that. But when I came back when I found out I was coming to Japan, I started looking up YouTube videos. Some of the stuff I watched was people going to places like Super Potato in Akihabara. And one of the channels I found was Luke Morse One, who I don't know who was doing hard off videos before that guy, but he had a whole series of videos where he would go to hard off. So he would like ride his bicycle and go look for games and stuff.
Yeah.
So that was how I even learned about it. So that was one of the things, like, I knew, I was like, okay, when I get there, like I can go and rebuy some old games and stuff. So my first weekend here, you get to the airbase, you have a sponsor, and they're there to like get you acclimated. And luckily my sponsor was a guy who was really into like video games and stuff too.
Yeah,
so
bonus.
Yeah, my first weekend there, I got here on a Wednesday. By that Sunday, he had taken me down to Akiba. And that first weekend, I went to Super Potato and bought a Super Famicom with like Rockman X and Zelda and I think Castlevania. And I brought that home with me. And then I had just a fucking, as soon as I was off from work, I was at home just like playing those games. And I was like, you know what? This is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Found out there were some hard offs dotted around the base. So those early hard off videos, I just would jump in my car and just go to the nearest place I could. And the games were so incredibly cheap. Just like 100 yen a piece is like less than $1.
Yeah.
So I would just load up on tons of games, maybe buy a new console that weekend.
Even now, when you're wandering through, you're picking up like, you know, a bunch of carts that are like $5 really, you know. Yeah. And if you try and buy those from someone on eBay, people are going to sting you $30, $40, $50. And you're just kind of like, sometimes you're going through those tubs of randoms. The things that get my attention the most is when you walk down an aisle of like, plastic wrapped Neo Geos, and there's just like 30 of them. And yes, they're expensive. Yes, it is like walking through, you know, a hallway with Porsches parked along every side. But just to see the mass of Neo Geo, like there's a cubic ton of Neo Geo just stacked against this wall. It's inconceivable to
It's nice to be able to just walk into a store and see that. You don't like have to go look for it online and just sort of trust the description.
Hope for the
of
best.
The
Yeah.
Just go and pick it up and hey, here it is. And if I want it, I can walk out with it right now.
So
that was my typical weekend while I was at Yokota. Was Friday nights, we're always going out and partying. Saturday, wake up, sort of, you know, recover a little bit and then get in the car, go down, go to this hard off, maybe go to two of them, load up on games, maybe get a new console, and then just like go home, maybe get a six pack on the way. And just like hang out and like play those games all weekend. And
did you have other buddies in the Air Force that were on a similar mindset as you?
Not particularly. The only person I can really remember hanging out with that was into game collecting and retro games and stuff was my friend Rob. And Rob had a channel of his own. And I think Rob was even on my channel a couple of times. I mentioned that while I was at Yokota, I deployed for 6 months. So I spent 6 months, I went to Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. And so I wasn't going to be putting any videos on my YouTube channel. I wasn't, you know.
Right.
So I just sort of asked some other people if they wouldn't mind making some videos for it in that 6 months.
Nice. Yep.
So Rob published one, and then I think some other friends I had from around YouTube did. So if you go back far enough, you'll find like a little section where I'm not even on my channel anymore, but they're like a half dozen videos by other people you might not even know who they are.
Yeah,
there wasn't a lot of people I could really like share that hobby with while I was at Yokota, but I didn't care because there was plenty of other shit you could do with other people at the same. I was into music. I played guitar.
Yeah.
I'll go to live houses and play music and hang out with my girlfriend or, you know, go drink beer or go out to Shinjuku or something. So there's plenty of other stuff I could do with other people. But yeah, for the most part, that whole gaming, game collecting, and even YouTubing at the time, that was something that was much more of like my own little private thing that I was doing. So that was kind of like a just for me kind of thing.
I guess when you're sort of buying and there's only finite space, and especially like I think a couple of times you've kind of turned the camera, especially in your last apartment, you've sort of turned the camera and you're kind of down behind this little like coffee table sort of squeezed in, and it, you know, no one quite understand, but when you turn the camera, you're like, so there's my bed, there's the corner of my room, there's a bookcase with all the stuff I can afford to keep, there's the other corner, there's the toilet, and there's the door out. It's kind of like a bit of a, you're like a kid in a candy store, but there's only so much you can keep for yourself. So collecting can be hard when you're like, I want to have this and this and this and this and this, but what am I going to do with it? Where am I going to put it?
Yeah.
It must be challenging.
I was living in the typical, I don't have any money, Tokyo apartment, yeah. where it's just, yeah, it's a tiny little space. Luckily, yeah, like I saved up for however long, like a year and a half or something. I have a, my current apartment is like, I don't know, maybe three and a half times bigger than the old one. So there's more, if I want to get a little more into collecting, you know, I can dedicate an entire room to it if I really want to. That's something I'm kind of like mulling over. I still have a lot of the stuff I had collected that was in the previous apartments. But at the same time, I'm wondering, I'm like, okay, do I like, do I want to get like more games, continue on with the whole collecting thing, or do I want to invest my money maybe in something else? Maybe like rediscover like another hobby I used to have, or I mean, even screw it, invest in maybe making YouTube a bigger thing. Maybe some more cameras would be nice, or better cameras, or better audio equipment, or you know, upgrading computers and software and all that kind of thing. So it's just one of the things where I'm still into collecting games and playing games and things like that. I'm just wondering what the future of it is right now. But I still do enjoy producing my videos, and I still have a lot of games to buy because I buy lots of games for other people. So it's still I get to enjoy game hunting.
Yeah, how does that work? I get the impression that you sort of through maybe a Discord or a Patreon or something that you kind of have these people that are like, hey, I'm looking for this, this, and this. And whilst you're out just hunting, you know, picking the mushrooms or whatever it is you're doing, you see this and you're like, hey, so-and-so wants that. Can you, 'cause that's a pretty unique thing. And I guess, you know, if you're looking at it from a viewer's, like to be, if I was watching a video, and it may, the video may get released after that cartridge is in my hand. And I see on the video, holy cow, he's picking out Rockman 5. That's the one he sent me. That has a real kind of warm, fuzzy feeling to it.
I would think so. It started out as that, as people, you know, just asking me, hey, can you get this for me? And I'm being like, all right, I'll see what I can do. And then having some friends that a large portion of their income was, you know, selling games and like Facebook groups and things like that.
Yeah.
And then being like, hey, I'm making actually a decent little living doing this. And so I started out that way, selling stuff through Facebook or people just messaging me wanting something and I'll try to get it for them.
Yep.
I eventually turned my Patreon. The most successful part of it is almost like a retro game loot crate sort of.
Yeah. Right.
Where you can, you know, tell me what consoles you want games for. And I can give you an assortment of games. You're kind of trusting my taste, but so far most people have you know, been pretty happy with it. And then you can make like specific requests too. Like, I would really like to have this if you can find it.
Yeah.
And then like, if I can find it, it goes in. If I can't find it in the amount of time that is reasonable for me to package it and send the box to you, then maybe we'll get it on the next try or something like that. Or you can just, you know, opt to just let your money roll over a month or two. And then you'll get like a box two or three times the size. Wow. Or if you, some people request like real collector's items, like, you know, particularly expensive games where it's like, okay, I can get that for you, but you're going to have to like wait a little while until this money adds up, almost like a layaway
for
like collecting those really rare games.
Yeah.
So I've been doing that as of late. So that's like, I go out, I buy all these games. Some of them I'm like, you know what? This needs to be cleaned and tested. So I'll come home and play with them for a little while before they'll go into a box or something. And sometimes when I'm out, I'm you know, buying up however many like hundreds of dollars worth of games for all the patrons. And then I'll find a couple of things I want for myself and I'll hang on to those.
Have you ever had something that you're like, you were, you know, oh, I've got to find this for person X, and you get it and you're like, oh, it's pretty cool. And then you take it home and you're like, I would rather just not put this in the package now. And you have that dilemma where you send it, but you're like, damn it, I really shouldn't be such a nice guy.
Yeah, well, like I said, I, you know, there are a few high rollers that pop up. The highest tier I have is $200. And you can get, you know, for $200, you can get either a lot of games or you can get, you know, a handful of, you know, fairly, you know, pricey, desirable games. But I had one gentleman, he wanted some real, some real heavy hitter stuff costing like $400-$600 a piece.
Wow.
You know, big collector's items. So he actually created two different profiles and signed them both up for the $200.
So he could give you more money, sort of thing.
Yes. And he sent me this whole list of, I mean, you name it, it was on there, like stuff like Hyperduel and Alien Soldier and just all this big money stuff, 400 for this, 600 for that, you know, just so yeah, that happens every once in a while where I get to go to the store, tell them to open up that glass case because I want that $600 game.
Oh man.
And then I've got it and I'm just like, you know what? I really, you know, to really do my due diligence, I really should test this thing out before sending that out to someone. So, yeah, it's kind of hard.
It reminds me of the Radioactive Man episode of The Simpsons where they're like, get all their money together for the comic for the edition. He's like, why don't you waddle over there and get that comic book? And it's just that moment of behind the curtain, getting the access to stuff. Yeah. I mean, I think what's astounding me the most, I watch you and also watch Scruffy RGB and like the past year or two for me has been sort of a lot of Game Boys and other consoles, but just and it, when the world sort of comes back to some sort of normality, we're going to visit Japan again, and I'd be like, everybody thinks they can go into Tokyo and pick up a bunch of cheap Game Boys, and yeah, the junk stuff might be there. And, around where I am and talking to, I've talked to 30 different guests, both from the US and through Europe. And, $100 gets you, in my neck of the woods, almost any Game Boy in almost any condition. It can be a nice, good condition SP, or it can be a GBA, or it can be a DMG. It looks like it's been dunked in a bucket of mud. And people just like $100. And then when I watch what's going on, like in Japan, it's sort of like it's $100 as well. It just seems to be this kind of a global economy of retro gaming. Is there like you see these cheap carts that are like $2, $3, $5 equivalent currency, but is there a real difference in what's going on there compared to the rest of the world, or is the whole world kind of going bonkers with retro gaming, this big bubble?
Well, I mean, there are like in Japan, like other places, there are like seriously like hardcore collectors. And so, like, I mean, that drives up the price because if you have something and you know it's like it's hard to justify to yourself, like, okay, I could sell this for like $600, or it could be like a nice guy and sell it for like, 400 or something or other. You don't want to be the nice guy, you want to get that money. So it's a similar mentality to you're going to find anywhere else. And then of course there is like Super Potato, for example, they have an eBay store now. So like they're selling to, foreign buyers all over the place. I'm doing the same thing. There are other people, like I said, I got friends that sell on Facebook and stuff like that. So there is a big demand internationally for Japanese games. And right now, like no tourist traffic whatsoever. I think the stuff they actually have physically in the stores, they have to be sort of, I don't know, maybe they have to be kind of careful with their pricing because their customer base is so much smaller for the brick and mortar stuff. But when it comes to selling online, I think because people have said that to me before, because they see my videos where I'll go to a Super Potato either in Akiba or Ikebukuro or somewhere and show like what this is going for this, or this is going for like a range of prices. And like, wow, it's like almost twice that much on like their eBay store. So I think there's that difference between like what people are willing to pay online because that's sort of maybe there's the feeling like, well, this is my only option versus an actual physical store where all you got is the foot traffic. So you have to sort of cater to that. So yeah, I guess you could say, yeah, it's kind of an international, it's a global game collecting, whatever it is, but those prices are up down, almost like a stock market, if you will.
Yeah, it is odd, isn't it? I spent a little bit of time in Pokemon cards for like a year and a half with my daughter, and it was kind of fun. And we bought a bunch of cards and we played a bit and stuff. And I bought a bunch of cards that were really nice. And when I bought them, and then 12 months later, 8 months later, I was like, oh, I want to get to something else. And I sold them. And the price was just like ridiculous. And it's like because some dude, a card you bought for a dollar, some dude played in a car, in a deck, into the national competition, and it crushed it. And all of a sudden, that card's now worth $13. And you're like, I can't handle this. I just feel like I'm having to, not only am I having to deal with the price of it, but I'm having to deal with the whims of a whole scene that one minute later is like just throwing cars to the curb. At least we retro gaming, there's a consistency in it. Yeah, the prices are going to vary, but the cart's always going to be the cart. Something I always wonder when I'm watching your videos specifically is that, like, obviously over here in the Western world, everybody's got this desire for Japanese games. Is there a market in Japan for like US or Europe only games?
It's very small. I will occasionally see. It was weird because I think the other day, or one of my more recent hard off videos, when I was looking through the junk section, I just in the junk section they had the Sega 6-pack for the Sega Genesis.
Right.
Like the US cartridge was just sat there in some junk section in some random hard off somewhere.
Oh, no.
But if you go to like a dedicated retro gaming shop, like again, like Super Potato, for example, they have a case where in the case they have some North American SNES games and things like that. And maybe some of them will.
Is there collectors in Japan that want the Japanese, the US carts to fulfill their collecting desires?
I'm sure there are, because people will collect basically anything. So I'm sure there are Japanese collectors that maybe a portion of their collection is North American PAL stuff.
Yeah.
I know in some circumstances, like for instance, the Mega Drive here, like two of the most expensive games you could possibly find for it are WWF Raw and I think Maximum Carnage.
Right.
Are two of the absolute most expensive games for the Mega Drive. And so for sort of a similar thing, whereas like some of the stuff I'll put into these boxes are games that maybe were released in North America or Europe, but that version is really exclusionarily like expensive.
Yeah.
Stuff like Guardian Heroes for the Sega Saturn, a lot of Sega Saturn stuff, some SNES games that were, you know, less common in the US. Here they're like super common. You pick them up for like $30 or something like that. That's one of the things that's pretty popular in those packages is I'll send those a less expensive version of something that would be, you know, really expensive where you are. I think that's part of it too, is that you could spend, I don't know, like $1,000 on WWF Raw or Maximum Carnage for the Mega Drive, or you could, I'm sure, a North American copy of either of those games you get it for like $20, $30 or something. Whoa, so that might factor in. Yeah.
Yeah. Something that's quite, I wouldn't say it's a majority of what you cover on your YouTube, but you obviously partake in is the arcades. And like we spent a couple of my daughter's like, you know, 9 years old. The time when we were there, 7 years old. So the whole, you know, the whole crane things and, you know, the UFO catcher, whatever people call them, like, it was just really bizarre for us to just walk into the bottom floor and just see 150 of these things and then sort of work our way through the levels of an arcade. I think the Sega one you're talking about that's closing, you know, I went to that one, a few of those, and it's, you walk into a place that's there for purpose. It's very rare these days to find them. I mean, that's something that you cover and something you see, and it's probably hard to really explain to people what it's like to go there, right?
It is now, because it's one of those things that you, if you've been here for like 10 years, you sort of take it for granted. Maybe you walk past those arcades, you know, however many, you know, times a week or something. It does kind of put in perspective though, when you take someone there.
Yeah.
So recently a friend of mine who's just moved here to start teaching, she's only been here like a month and a half. We met up earlier in the week and I took her to Akihabara, and, you know, she was like loving it, and she was, you know, taking pictures and, you know, checking everything out. And I was like, well, let's go into this arcade. And we went to Sega number 3 in Akiba, where if you go up to the 6th floor, it's all retro. So they're referring to it as Retro G right now.
Right.
So we were looking at all the crane games and stuff, and she was like, oh, this is cute, whatever, blah blah blah. And then I was like, well, let's get on the elevator. And we go up to the 6th floor and we come out, and she just fucking lost it. She was like, oh my god, like she hadn't seen something like that in ages, you know. Like it's a floor filled with like tons and tons of video games that you actually want to play. Like so don't know, I think she said that she was playing Virtua Fighter and all kinds of other stuff. We're playing some Crazy Taxi and Outrun and Street Fighter. We were just up there for a good long while just playing games. And that kind of puts it into perspective where a lot of these arcades, I've been going to them for a long time, Sega or Mikado, which they have two Mikado locations. Those are just strictly retro arcades, and those are awesome. Taito Hirose Entertainment Yard is a great one. So I've been going to these arcades for like a decade now. And at a certain point, it all kind of becomes normal. And it is great to just bring someone there for the first time and see their reaction to it. And then sort of it kind of reminds you, oh yeah, this is pretty damn cool. This is a kind of a lucky space and time I've got here to enjoy this.
Is there kind of like a difference between, like, obviously, like, if you know, being a you know, a retro gamer myself and a collector and interest in this and that and the other, if you said to me, Skirt, give me five retro arcade games, and I'd be like, well, let's go with like Space Invaders, Pac-Man, you know, Asteroids, you know, Moon Buggy, and a few basic ones like that, maybe a bit of like 942 and things like that. Is there if you asked like the average kind of 48-year-old Japanese guy the same question, are the answers going to be pretty similar, or is there like this whole other world of Japanese retro that we've not really witnessed because we're Western retro?
It probably would be very similar. I mean, Space Invaders was...
They're pretty generic, like international kind of examples, I suppose.
Well, I had heard that Space Invaders was like, it was so popular in Japan at the time that whatever the coin it was that the machines were taking, it might have been 10 yen coins or something. But they had to
print a whole bunch of extras.
They had to make more coins because Space Invaders was just out of fucking control.
Yeah.
And even today, when you see those Taito arcades, the logo on them is still one of the little Space Invader guys.
Like,
it's just universally known.
I think when Pac-Man came out, there was a lot of like sort of, I guess, would be known as like mums and pops little laundries and fruit places. And then when Pac-Man came out, they kind of just went and got rid of all that and just put like a dozen Pac-Man machines in and just crushed it. I don't know if that happened in America or Australia or England. Like, they might have got a few in an arcade, but I don't know if they went, you know what, it's better for us to have 12 machines than do laundry.
Yeah, well, I think it was because even like my first real experiences with arcade games were my aunt and uncle. I don't think they do anymore, but for the longest time, like decades, they managed a convenience store in my hometown. And they used to basically babysit me there a lot, give me like soda and snacks and... it was also a little bomb and pop like video store, like one of those shitty little video stores.
Like the best ones.
B movies and stuff. So I could also sit behind the counter and watch movies. But they would get arcade cabinets in there eventually. And that's I think the first game I can remember playing, the first arcade game they got in there, I was 5 years old. It was a game called Tubin. Which is your little guys in inner tubes.
Yeah, in the River Rapids.
Yeah, you navigate your way down the river. They had some other stuff in there, some kind of generic things I can't remember. But then one day they got a Street Fighter II, the World Warrior cabinet in there. And I remember just watching my cousin playing it and just being like, holy crap. Because some of my favorite movies to sit and watch behind the counter were like Van Damme movies. And stuff. I was super into like these martial arts stuff by Canon, like all the Van Damme stuff, the American Ninja
series was just,
and I was like 6 years old. I was just obsessed with this stuff. And then there it is. It's like they took all of that and they put in a video game. Now there's karate guys like fighting each other.
It's Bloodsport, so but I can be the guy.
Yeah, I thought it was the coolest thing ever. So as soon as I could, you know, being still a little kid, they would, again, they're babysitting me more or less. So to sort of keep me out of the way, they're like, okay, here's like a few quarters, pull a stool up to the machine here, go ahead and play the game. So that was sort of my first real experience with arcade games. And that was really common in the US, I guess, was a lot of convenience stores, places like that would have at least a couple of machines in there to bring in a little extra money. And then again, when I was a kid, if you went, you were in like the lobby of a Walmart, you could play maybe a few arcade games or like pinball. If you went to the movie theater, they would always have a little section off to the side of the lobby where you could go play some games there. And the most popular games at that time, like mid-90s, were light gun games. Like it was like Light Gun and Mortal Kombat. So okay, you play Mortal Kombat 3 or Area 51, which is it going to be?
That's unreal.
So yeah, arcade games were just like, there were arcades. Like if you went to the mall, you could go to Aladdin's Castle or something like that and play some arcade games. I remember my friends, when we were like 13 or 14, they got really into Initial D.
Right.
And so they were like so psyched. They had their little player cards and everything like that. They were just like really, really psyched about it. And actually, when I came back to Japan, that was one of the things when I went back into the arcades, I immediately started playing a shit ton of Initial D.
Yeah.
I had my card and everything. But that was kind of how it was where I grew up. Where it was like, there weren't really like arcades per se, but you could go and play arcade games sort of sparsely dispersed, like, at the Walmart or at the bowling alley or at the movie theater or something like that.
One thing I found most interesting when I went, well, there was two things when I went through an arcade in Tokyo, one of these Segas or something like that. But it was, as I said before, was right into the Gundam at the time. And I walked up and there's like it's like the Star Wars pod racer pod, but it was for Gundam dual stick, and you're in there, it's all like round, and I was like, I'm gonna go play that, and I kind of managed to find it, and I walked in and there was a floor of about 30 of them and I was like, you are kidding me, there's 30 people in here. And I actually found it challenging to find one that wasn't already occupied, and I kind of went in and got fairly hosed, but the whole experience of, because it was all like 30 person multiplayer. The other thing I found extremely kind of like confusing was initially I was doing most of my hunting looking for like hobby stuff, and then it was sort of retro gaming stuff around. It was all like selling these cards, and I was like, what is this? And when I went up to this particular floor, there was people playing either a horse racing game or like a soccer game, and lots of smoking, still lots of smoking in the arcades. And they're basically just putting these sort of cards that must have some sort of like an NFC type thing in them, and using these cards to put the players in position, and literally sort of just watching it unfold. That was pretty interesting.
So like, I see it, I'm like, that's kind of cool, but at the same time I'm like, I'm not particularly interested in the fast-paced world of like horse.
What was the card themselves? Yeah, like what is the card thing about? Like, do you get them out of like randoms like you do Pokemon, or can you buy the card and you sort of build your team like a team manager type thing?
I really wish I could tell you, because I've never actually played one of those games. I've never owned any of those cards ever. I have to imagine that's how it is. You get what you get, and then you sort of play your hand when you're playing the game. But I don't know the first thing about them. Like, I filmed them sometimes. I've said that in videos countless times, where like, I like to, if I go to a really big arcade, I like to film each floor and sort of give you an idea of what all they have in that arcade. And then I'll usually get to a floor where they'll say it's network games. And I'll get there and it'll be stuff like that. It'll be like the horse racing or some sort of strategy stuff or soccer games. And I'm just sort of like, I don't know what the hell any of this is. But these people, they sure seem interested in it. So we're going to watch them play for a little bit, but then we're going to get out of here, because I have no frame of reference for what's going on when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah, I've always wondered how the filming works. In some places it's going to vary, obviously, like you said, there's pricks everywhere, but there's also people that are kind of accepting what it is. And I think, you know, historically there's always been that, you know, the Japanese tourist taking the photos and all that sort of stuff, but then there's also seems to be this showing respect and respecting people's sort of privacy and things like that. And I would have expected that Japan was one of those places where you really need to kind of like you're not supposed to eat as you're walking down the street. You step off to the side. So how does the filming go within their culture? Are you 99% it's cool and you just kind of walk around, or?
Yeah. Just don't be a dick.
Yeah.
It's not a terribly complex thing. I mean, there are some places where you'll go and maybe there'll be a sign posted or someone will make a request, like, please don't shoot videos here or take pictures and stuff. And it's like, okay, fine. But most places, just don't be too like intrusive. Like, I have a little GoPro camera and I'm not running up shoving it in people's faces. A lot of my videos, I'm not specifically like focusing in on people or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Like if I want to get a shot of maybe someone playing a game or something, it's not a real chore to just be like, excuse me, do you mind if I record you playing this game?
Mm.
And 9 out of 10 times they'll just nod and say they don't give a shit. It's the same thing. If I was sitting down at a game cabinet or something and some random person was like, hey, can I film you playing this game? Sure, why not?
Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah.
So just don't be a jerk about it.
Yeah.
And if you want to film someone, whenever possible, ask for permission. Obviously, if you're just walking around out in the street, you're not going to ask every random passerby, oh, excuse me, was that okay that you were in the video? Like, no, you're walking down a public street. It's not a big deal. So, but no one usually cares. Like if I'm at a game store or something like that, I'm not running around filming people. I'm focused on the games and things.
Yeah. So. I get the impression that you do a lot of filming and then you watch it back and you dialogue over it. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
That is correct.
So you're not walking around sort of mumbling to yourself and kind of throwing things around. You're just kind of going about your business. And then later on you come home and because sometimes you sort of go, I think that was that and that looks like that and couldn't quite catch the price and things like that.
I sometimes, usually like the lead in and stuff like that, that'll be all like in camera audio or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. But then for the actual game hunting segments, part of that was because I was starting to get copyright claims for that hard off music.
Oh, right.
So I was like, this is playing
in the background sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, I need a workaround for this because obviously it's easier to just record it live and then it's done. You're done.
Yeah.
But I was like, well, I'm not going to keep getting these freaking copyright claims. So like, you know what? I'll just kill the camera audio and I'll just do a voiceover, maybe add some music or something.
Yeah.
And I've been doing that ever since. It wasn't like an artistic choice. It was just copyrights claims kept coming.
Just going back to the video stuff, I know when I was there, I did just with my phone, I did like a sort of a medium paced lap around Gundam Base, like up and down all the shelves of all the Gundam and stuff like that. And it was just sort of like I put it on, I think, YouTube, but it was more like just for those that haven't been here and you don't think it's awesome, this is it. And it was about 3 minutes of me just walking around, my phone on my chest. And like for me, when I was going, that's the sort of videos I was looking for. Is it worth my time traveling across town to make that trip and visit? And the amount of people that are like, oh, you really should have slowed down. I couldn't see the prices. It's like,
Welcome to my world. They're like, wait a minute. Like I'm in a store. There's literally like thousands and thousands of games. And they're like, you just walked past whatever the hell like that is, dude. I walked past 1,000 games. In that 30-second span. But that happens sometimes. Whatever, but it's just one of like with the camera thing. It's like it's not like people don't know what YouTube and YouTubers are. It's very common to see people just walking around, even with just stuff on a gimbal, just walking and shooting things and stuff like that. There are some people that's all they do is they do those walking videos.
So it's like 4K dust through Akihabara stuff.
Yeah, night walk from here to there, and it's like an hour and a half, and they just walk around, and it's just the ambient noise and everything like that. And those videos do very well. They get very high views. I'm making the wrong kind of video. I literally just walk and don't say anything and then bam. But like, so it's not uncommon at all to see people just walking around with cameras, just sort of filming streets and whatever else. And people in general get it. Okay, they're like a YouTuber or something. It's not such an uncommon sight anymore.
Yeah. What's the sort of like for Jim? What's Jim looking for? Like, do you have a sort of a few things that are really that you're really looking for in these stores? Like gems? Is there one particular Dreamcast? And if you find it, that game, you're going to be like, I'm done. That's it. I'm done. Or any of that sort of stuff. Or,
geez, you know, at this point, you know, I don't think there is. I've been doing this for like a decade. I've seen just about everything I could ever want. Usually if I didn't leave with it, it was just because it was too expensive. Yeah, there's still some stuff on the Saturn and on the Mega Drive and PC Engine, some games I'd really like to have.
Mm.
And I've come across them, I've seen them, they're there, and I'm just like, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and not buy you. I'm going to be a little bit responsible with my money today. So no, nothing particularly that, like, I've never been able to find it. So it's eluded me all this time. It's my white whale, but... Yeah. Just stuff that's, you know, maybe someday if I'm making like way more money, I would like, find, you know, go back and instead of buying that game for like a patron or something, buy it for myself next time. Nothing I'm desperately seeking out now.
I guess there's also the point that you're seeing, like obviously there's high end stuff in the cabinets and things like that. But as far as sort of what, like, to be honest, you know, you're kind of walking through a field kind of kicking stones that probably contain gems to someone else somewhere else. Yeah. And because you're experiencing in such abundance, I guess there's sort of like there's a calmness. Like if you turned around, if you like rolled over in bed tomorrow morning and went, and if you don't already, you're like, I want to own a copy of every Rockman. Just, I'm going to do that tomorrow. And I could probably do it for a few $100. You just can. And there's a calmness in having the accessibility as opposed to someone who's really working hard to achieve the same goal. And therefore, you don't have to kind of freak out, and your hunter-gatherer sort of person inside is just a bit more relaxed, leaving you open to sort of explore more.
That's why I have to remind myself of just sort of the good fortune that I have to be able to do all that stuff. And that's why it's always nice to have somebody with you that's experiencing it for the first time.
Yeah.
So that you can be like, yeah, I remember that's how. So yeah, it's become, again, like after like a decade, it's become kind of routine. Yeah. But just every once in a while, I remind myself, or especially like looking at the comment sections and some of the comments being like, oh man, like I just saw this on that shelf. Oh, that game is so awesome. Or, oh, I've been wanting that for so long, or something like that. Or they're just like people that like binge watch some of my videos and they're just like, oh man, you get that comment where like, I've just watched like 20 of your videos. I just love this so much. All the games, et cetera, et cetera. So that kind of stuff really reminds you like, okay, yes, this is kind of a special set of circumstances I have here. I should be more appreciative.
Yeah.
But then again, when you go to the shop and then you got your backpack full and you got all the bags and stuff like that, and you're just like, fucking hell, I just want to go home. To hell with these damn games.
Yeah, yeah.
They're more trouble than they're worth.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Yeah. There's several videos that I've consumed of yours several times. And often, like, I work with electronics on a bench, and I can just put my phone over there and I have headphones on. And often it's just, it'll be playing, but I obviously have to focus on what I'm doing. I can just listen to you kind of like rummaging and just going through stuff and sort of talking about it. And just there's an experience without having to actually watch you go past every single game. And there's been times where you'll just walk past all the Game Boys. And I'm like, Jim. Oh, okay. Maybe not this video, but
yeah.
I still find it very interesting just to listen to you talk about whatever this is and what that is. You definitely are blessed. You also do a lot of the sort of pop-up shops and things like that, which I guess mixes it all up a bit too. And it's such a, I know when I was there, I didn't get to take my daughter, who's now older, would appreciate it more, you know, Akihabara, but just the level of sort of intertwinedness of all that pop culture in one space. Like, you can go to somewhere here in Australia, it might just be comics, and there's another place that might be just be games, but this is just this like whole world. And when these pop-up shops come up, they're just these little eruptions of gold in the middle of what is already, you know, a city of gold.
Yeah, and it's gotten to the point where like sometimes like I don't know what's coming. I don't know what the hell. And then I'll just get messages from people being like, hey, there's going to be this thing. You should go check it out. So like a bunch of that stuff, like I didn't even like know on my own that it was going to be there. But now I guess people are accustomed to me going and filming that kind of thing, that they'll just, if there's something that they're interested in and they want to see it, I'll hear about it because they want me to go shoot a video for it. Mm-hmm. I went to this place recently because somebody sent me a thing saying that they were going to have Cowboy Bebop stuff there. Like it was a little Cowboy Bebop. I thought it was going to be a pop-up shop, like the yep. floor was going to be Cowboy Bebop. Yep. And I went up there and it was just like one like little area, like a little shelf. And like that was all it was. So I was like, oh, okay. Well, I'm here anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm supposed to shoot. In the past, like some people, they'll tell me it's there because not just they want the video, they want some stuff. They want a few things.
Yeah.
One prime example of that was I had gotten a message from Johnny Millennium, the happy console gamer.
Yep.
And he is a massive fan of an 80s anime called Megazone 2-3.
Right.
And I'd gotten a message from him being like, oh, there's going to be a Megazone 2-3 pop-up shop. You have to go. And he was like looking at on the website, all the t-shirts and shit they were going to have. And he was like, I want this, this, and that. And I was like, all right. So I went and made a video out of it and then got his t-shirts for him and everything like that. That's just sort of an example. Someone recently sent me a thing where they're doing an art, sort of an art expo thing where it's Capcom versus Osamu Tezuka, which is like the creator of things like Astro Boy.
Right.
And I think like, King of the White Lion, stuff like that. A lot of classic. He's like, I think he's referred to as being the Walt Disney of Japan. So right. they're doing sort of an art expo of like Capcom crossed over with his characters and artwork and stuff. So
yeah,
something I'm thinking I would, it's opening on October 1st. So I'm thinking to go and if they'll let me film, go get a little bit, a little bit of that.
Awesome. Awesome. It blew me away. Like, as far as say Gundam was my thing at the time, but just kind of walking around a corner and just seeing like not even Akihabara, like we stayed in Shinjuku for a bit, and even to sort of walk around the corner and sort of see this 8-foot banner on the side of a electronics store of like a Gundam, and just sort of going, what? Like, hang on, because like straight, you know, it's usually that kind of signage is sort of reserved for like, you know, big electronics or sports or alcohol or something like that. And to see it like proud and loud, I went to I found this kind of it's about a 8-foot bronze statue of the RX-78, and I had to catch a train one morning like kind of northwest. And I really got out in those sort of suburbs and got off the train and went to a bakery. And all of a sudden, the lady there couldn't really work with my English. And I kind of just pointed and stuff. And there was this random like RX-78 bronze statue that at some point they were trying to create some sort of festival in the 90s or something. So they made this statue to try and turn this area into a potential site. And it kind of never took off. And there was just all these little random things around that they just give it so much, and all of a sudden it doesn't pay off. And they're like, oh, well, it doesn't mean you got to get rid of it. You know, you just enjoy it and it just becomes part of the terrain.
That's there was a place I went to. I went there to go to a Hard Off. And that's the thing is sometimes I'll just Google map where Hard Offs are and then I'll just go there.
Yeah.
And this one place in particular is this place called Oizumi.
Right.
And I didn't know anything about the place, but when I got there, right outside the station, again, I was like, there are all these bronze statues of all these different anime characters from like all these different things. And apparently, like, Oizumi had been somewhere where there was some sort of maybe an animation studio, or it was this place that produced all this really classic anime.
Mm.
And so they just had this sort of like plaque to like commemorate that, and it had a message about it. And there's all these statues of all these anime characters. And it's just one of those like cool little surprises where I had no idea that was going to be there.
Yeah.
But I just stepped off the train and there it is.
Yeah.
And so, there's just, you find that's the thing with like Japan, but like Tokyo in general, is that Tokyo was like massive. And it feels, you know, they say it's the biggest city in the world. But it feels like this giant city that's made up of all these interconnected little towns.
Yeah.
Kind of. And so, and a lot of them have their own little quirks and their little things, you know, and it's like you find something kind of cool and new just by going out and exploring, you know?
Yeah. Thinking back to like those people that walk around, just do like 4K walk from here to there. And I think probably one of the highlights for us, and probably for most people that go to Tokyo, is like the Shibuya crossing, and just sort of being there and sort of being afraid to kind of get trampled and stuff. But you know, this person gets off the train and walks out, and we're like, "That's where we came out." They walk across, they go up this alley and that alley, and then they go past this little the sushi place. It's like it's not a train. It's like when you order on the tablet, just a single carriage kind of zips out with your stuff, and you take your stuff and zips back. You know, and then we also did like you know, have you, you would have been to the robot restaurant, the thing that's like three levels underground. And it's like, it's like a cross between sort of like, I don't know, Autobots and like the latest Mad Max film. It's just this noise. And all we were thinking was, if something catches on fire down here, we're all screwed. It was just, it's just insane, you know, but watching those videos, you can see, like you said, around every corner is just this little space, and around another corner is a space, like even Takashita Street, you know, across the road is that I can't remember the name of the temple, those grounds there, but you walk out of Takashita and you go past the train station, you cross over, you cross the bridge, you walk into the trees under the temple arch, and you can't even see the city. All of a sudden you are just hidden away. And Japan, what I can say, Tokyo has this ability to kind of like, when you're somewhere or doing something, if you're eating noodles, if you're in an arcade, if you're in a temple, if you're buying squishy bread, it is focused on just doing it the right way, 100%. And when you leave, you've done that. Now go do something else. It's just bizarre.
It's just one of my favorite things to do now is just go find those little side streets and all the kind of like little hidden areas. Yeah. One of my favorite places in Shinjuku is Golden Guy, which I had not, I remember just one night I was hanging out in a heavy metal bar in Kabukicho.
Yeah.
And someone was just sitting there talking to me, and we were just talking about, you know, music and I think movies or something. He was like, you know, there's this other bar down in Golden Guy we should go check out. I was like, what's Golden Guy? And he was, I'd been here for like 3 years and I didn't know about it because it's kind of like that. It's like tucked away, you know, back there somewhere where it's like, it's right next to Kabukicho, but Kabukicho is like so loud and obnoxious, you can't miss it.
Yeah.
And you're going to go over there and then you're, you know, you could potentially never even see this area or even know it was there.
Yeah.
So he took me there and it's just, it's a little area. It's just nothing but all these tiny little bars that seat like a maximum of like 7 to 10 people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're all different themes and all kinds of stuff. And he took me to a bar called Deathmatch in Hell, which is, it's a heavy metal bar, but it's also horror movie and B-movie themed.
Right.
And this was years ago. And that night I met the owner, Go. And now Go is like, he's a good friend of mine. Hang out, you know, chill out all the time. And still, like, whenever I can, I swing by that bar. And he's a big collector. He's even got his own YouTube channel now where he goes and does all kinds of stuff. But he's a big collector. He likes to collect B-movies and, like, VHS and things like that. And even in his bar, on the counter, there are all these VHS cassette tapes lining the bar of all these, like, old movies. There's stuff all over the bar. Yeah. There are a couple of TVs in there that are running old horror movies and stuff, like, you know, at all times. So, I don't know. Yeah. I wouldn't have found that little place unless somebody had shown it to me, because it is pretty well tucked away back there. And now I don't Kabukicho, I'm like, F that, I don't even want to go there anymore. I just want to go straight to Golden Guy, you know.
Yeah, I can remember us walking down those kind of like laneways, and left and right was just a door and a bar for about 6 to 8 people, and then a door, and it's like, and someone explained to me, was like, all that person serves in there is like 2 types of whiskey, you know. And the next bar is like, all they serve is just this one beer. Yeah, and you might just sort of work your way down the alleyway and the laneway, and maybe this guy sells a little bit of these octopus balls and a particular type of rice wine, and it's just these very specified tastes, but you know when you go there, it's going to be perfect. It's going to be the same every time.
Yeah, it's best to just walk into some of them without knowing what to expect. I've met a lot of friends in that area. I can remember just once, I don't even remember what the name of the bar was, but we went in and it was the most just like gaudy, like the walls were all leopard print. They were playing like 90s, early 90s, like techno dance beat music, and like Black Box and stuff like that. And I was oh my God, what the hell?
Yeah.
I was like, well, I hate and love this place at the same time.
Yeah.
We're going to hang out here. Some good stuff.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay. Well, look, I've kept you for that hour and a half that I promised I would. And I guess there's the opportunity to kind of like wrap it up. And if there's anything else that you want to share, I mean, this is all about Jim and getting to know Jim a bit more, because you can get a lot from your YouTube or your Instagram, but it's very interesting to know someone a little more. And when next time you're walking down the street, I'm going to feel so much more attached to your experience and understand a bit more of what you're going through and the efforts you go to, because it's a fairly loveless kind of activity in a lot of ways. So this is your opportunity to kind of like plug anything you like, or, I mean, share maybe some plans you have. I always do a bit of a shout out for someone, and it's up to you. You might just sort of go, look, everybody, I love everybody. And often people will sort of say, look, if you just follow me, you'll see who I follow. This particular episode, I'm going to kick the can for an Instagrammer called Stovaloni, Stoveloni. And it's just, I always put the links in the show notes and stuff, but it's just, this guy can just take like an OG PlayStation controller or a GameCube or a GBA or something. There's lots of black and white, really clean photography. And for my Instagram, it's just, I want to look at my feed and just feel good and maybe want to go spend some money, or I want to go to my games room. So yeah, that's my kick in the can for this week. And now the opportunity is there for you to, promote yourself or others, or let us know what you're up to and what your plans are. And yeah, and we can sort of wrap it up from there. Hey.
All right. Stuff to plug. As far as like other people go, I will plug, I mentioned Deathmatch in Hell. Yeah. You can actually go and find Go on YouTube. Just search Deathmatch in Hell. And you'll see my buddy Go walking around, going to some interesting places, showing you some little side streets and shops and doing his thing. And he's one of the most lovable people in the world.
Yep.
So you'll definitely enjoy that. My good friend Dennis, he has his YouTube channel called Den Densetsu. And Dennis, he does game reviews. He's also a huge, huge Mega Man fan. Like, he's obsessive about it. So he has an entire series dedicated to Mega Man called Metal Heroes.
Wow.
Where he does little deep dives on the various robot masters and things like that.
Awesome.
You mentioned earlier scruffy looking RGB.
Yep.
He's a great guy, friend of mine, love to hang out and shoot this shit with him. So he's awesome. His videos are great. Does game hunting. He does refurbishing videos and things like that.
Yep.
So he's always awesome. And one other thing I will plug is coming up, October 5th is going to be the premiere at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood. It is a movie called Rarity, Retro Video Game Collecting in the Modern Era. And it will be featuring the likes of James Rolfe, the Angry Video Game Nerd, Metal Jesus, John Riggs, John Hancock, wow, some of the people you'll know from YouTube, a yep, bunch of other people that they're known for things outside of YouTube. And for some really strange, unknown reason to me, I am also in this movie.
Oh, congrats.
Thank you very much. So if you want to go and see, I mean, whoever's in California, it's eventually going to be streaming on various other sites. I think one of the sites it'll be streaming on is called Tubi,
right?
Which is nice because that's a free site. I think another one is called Plex. It'll get a Blu-ray release at some point.
Okay.
But yeah, it's called Rarity, Retro Game Collecting in the Modern Era. The director is a good guy by the name of Payson. I think, is it David Payson? But he's a director of a lot of B horror movies and stuff like that. But as it turns out, he's a game collector. He's really into the retro gaming world, and he just wanted to make a documentary about game collecting. Edward Payson, that's his name. Edward Payson.
Awesome.
So that'll be premiering on October 5th as part of the Silicon Beach Film Festival. And right, that'll be in Hollywood. And awesome. Then eventually you'll be able to see that movie on whatever else, streaming services, Blu-ray, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, outstanding. All right. And so I guess just to summarize then, so what's Jim's plans? Are you pretty comfy there? I mean, do you have a sort of like a, is that as a US citizen, do you only get 10 years and you got to bugger off, or
No,
you're good to stay there forever and just keep doing what you're doing.
Pretty much.
Yep.
Until I find a good reason to leave, I'm not going to. I'm here on my visa. Maybe eventually, like after a certain amount of time, like 10 years, I could potentially get permanent residency.
Yeah.
And never have to get a visa again. But the plan right now is to stay in Japan, to carry on with YouTube, to carry on teaching. I'm looking forward to working on stuff with other YouTubers right now. I mentioned earlier Happy Console Gamer.
Yeah.
He, myself, and Jimmy Hoppe are currently working on a collaboration video together.
Yeah.
Which will hopefully be coming out, I don't know, maybe in the next month or so. So that's cool. So that's going to be like cool for me to work with a much bigger YouTuber and someone I've been watching for a really long time and someone I've known for a number of years. And we just haven't really hammered out something to do together yet. So this is going to be something I'm looking forward to seeing. Again, I don't know where this movie is going to go. Like, I haven't seen it. I don't know anything. Like, I'm hoping it does really well. So that might be some nice exposure for me. I'm not 100% sure. I'm actually thinking about trying to dip my toes into the voice acting world.
Oh yeah.
I have a couple of friends who are voiceover artists. One friend in particular has been in the voiceover game here in Japan for like 30 years now. He's just done everything. He and I have become, you know, pretty good friends. And so we've talked about that, the prospect of him helping me get into that whole scene. Because it's kind of, as he explained to me, when you're a voiceover artist, it's something that a lot of people want to get into. So it's kind of like their little code that you don't share agents and you don't, you do whatever you can to keep the pool of voice actors small.
Right, keep the work coming sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know. We've been buds for a while. We've worked on some stuff together and sometimes we just hang out and get drunk. Mm. And so he's, you know, willing to help me with that. So that might be something I do in the future. I've got some friends that's weird. I'm one of the, like, I'm a little guy that knows a bunch of big guys is kind of how I could maybe explain it. So I have some friends who have some really deep pockets that when borders open up, they're looking at coming out here on business investment visas and potentially even opening up a barcade and doing stuff like that. And they want me to help them out with that. So as of right now, me and another friend of mine are, we've got an immigration lawyer friend and we're trying to facilitate those things for those people. So that might even be something else I dabble in, is assisting them with the establishment of a business.
Oh, wow.
These are plans, but you know, stuff that could potentially happen.
Yeah, I mean, you got to have a finger in a bunch of pots, I guess, and just hope one of them boils over. That's awesome. Yeah. But I mean, you've got that comfort of just kind of like falling back on, you know, and kicking around hard offs and teaching. And I guess I think you've sort of expressed a number of times through your YouTube that you just got to kind of be comfy with it and just enjoying it. And you go home and play some games. That's what we all have in common.
And it's just one of those things where, like, I had always saw myself as like a small, insignificant YouTuber. And it was nothing I ever took too terribly seriously. But it's just one of those things where you don't know who's watching.
Yeah.
And by just doing what I was doing and sort of being dedicated to it, now it's like I have friends that work in, they're like high level positions at like Sony Interactive. They're making these big decisions about what games get published onto PlayStation.
Yeah.
And I met them because they liked watching, they were game collectors and they just like watching my YouTube channel. And so they're like, hey, I live in Ebisu. Do you want to hang out or something? I'm like,
oh, wicked.
Yeah, sure. So, but it's just by just doing that. And like, it's almost like you just do that, you put it out there and then you forget about it.
Yeah.
And then you don't think about, well, who's watching it?
Yeah.
So because I was making my stupid little YouTube videos, well, now I'm in a movie that's premiering in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Now I know all these like veteran voice actors and these people that have been in the gaming industry for decades. Yeah. I know millionaires. I know all these fucking people.
Yeah.
It's just because I was making my stupid little, you know, YouTube videos dicking around, you know.
Yeah. 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 So I mean, it's one thing to really cultivate like a plan and a career, but it's I've had this discussion with people many times. It's really rewarding when it's something just sort of organically just pops up and just sort of its own accord, just because you're just doing your thing and it starts to gain momentum and you're like, wow, this is really nice. I'm happy with how this is going. It's slightly effortless. There's still work, but it's not like I think about these stories of people that went to LA to get into Hollywood and they just ended up waiting tables. And like, that's the worst end of the scale. You're doing exactly what you want and the result is just good organic growth and fulfilling some of the things that you didn't even think were going to happen.
Yeah, it's I don't know, it's crazy. Can't explain it. It's just I don't know, just something I was having fun with, and it turned into something. Even if it stopped, ended like tomorrow, I just couldn't do YouTube or anything like that ever again. I still it was pretty cool. So I don't know. I'm happy with it. I'm happy with what I've done so far.
Well, all power to you, buddy. Just as a general, one of the 28,200 subscribers, I just enjoy seeing you wandering around looking at things. And you know, I have a yearning to go back to Japan and throw my dollars at these cabinets and things like that. And until then, I can watch Jim wander around and just know that it's all still there. And it's good. Yeah. And hopefully it'll be there when it's all sort of settled down. So from me, thank you. It's good. It's a good thing.
Absolutely. Let me be your comfort blanket.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Shush now. Shush.
Yeah, everything will be all right.
Okay. All right, buddy. Thanks so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. Sunday Arvo, you probably got some things to do. If not, you got nothing to do, and that's just as good. So
Well, there's beer that needs drinking.
There is beer that needs drinking. Again, thank you. This will be available for everybody to listen to on all the different platforms. So hopefully a few more people sort of go, who's this Jim guy? And go along and join the numbers. So it's what it's all about, promoting people that I think are kind of being, you know, organic and just enjoying it and sharing it. So get amongst it. And we'll maybe chat in the future. And if not, just know that whenever you put those videos up, I'm one of those people just sitting back watching it going, yeah, Jim, you're living the dream. You are living the dream.
Absolutely, buddy. And next time you're in Tokyo, just drop me a line and the beers are on me.
Oh, I think the beers will be on me because you'll be showing me, you'll be showing me all these places to throw my money over the counter and things like that.
Right.
All right, buddy.
That's what I'm good at.
Thank you so much. And you enjoy the what's left of your weekend, hey?
Absolutely. And thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.